Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What the joy of cooking is for American food, cocina criolla is for Puerto Rican. Journalist Von Diaz started cooking her way through that book.
The project really started as this kind of sentimental homage to my grandmother, who I call Tata, who was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And she was an incredible cook, and she can't cook anymore. So in a lot of ways, it just started as me paying tribute to her. But as soon as I dove into the actual recipes and started making things like beef tongue and whole turkeys swaddled in lard cloth, it then became a project that was so much about culture and identity and understanding the history of an island's cuisine that's fiercely underexplored.
Feet in Two Worlds, a project on immigration, women, and food. And more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In 2009, Time magazine named Chef Dan Barber one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Now, that didn't happen solely because he knocks out some of the best-tasting food to be found on a fork. It happened because, as a farm kid turned chef, Dan questioned how we eat, how our food systems work, and especially agriculture. In fact, farm to table was coined by a critic describing Dan's first restaurant, Blue Hill, in New York City. That was in 2000. The descriptor grew when he opened a second place that was actually on a farm, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, part of the experimental Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture. Now in his new book, he turns the vision of local, organic, and sustainable on its ear. The book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Dan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Dan, what do you mean by the third plate?
Well, so the third plate is not a literal plate of food. It's a metaphor for a way of eating, a pattern of eating, a diet, even a cuisine. I don't mean cuisine in the haughty sense. I mean cuisine in the sense that it creates a structure for how you tackle a meal for your family and how you tackle a meal for the season, depending on where you are and what the weather conditions are. I mean, that's what cuisine is all about. It's about celebrating a sense of place. And so the third plate is an attempt to create some more structure out of a farm-to-table movement that has a ton of labels. We have grass-fed meat. We have local. We have organic. We have tons of labels that rarely are forced to be brought together into a system of farming, a system of eating that is truly both delicious and sustainable. And that's what I'm calling the third plate.
So what would be an example?
Well, I travel all over the world sort of in search of these ingredients that I find delicious, and I mean really truly delicious. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered in my search is that it's not about the ingredient or even about the specific farming technique that produced the ingredient. It's about the system that supports, a whole ecology, really. And that sounds a little frou-frou, but I'll give you an example, which is from Blue Hill Farm. Blue Hill Farm is a dairy farm that my grandmother started in the 1960s, and then my brother and I have taken over. And it produces dairy for the restaurant, sells retail as well. And what we realized very quickly as we got into the business of dairying is that while it was important to support the dairy through buying the milk, of course, we needed to do a lot more. So, for example, every spring we have births on the farm. It's called calving. And 50% of the cows that are born are female. Those are the future milkers of the farm. And 50% are male, roughly speaking. And the question for dairy farms is, What do you do with the males? Because they're not producing any milk. In fact, they are subtracting a lot because they drink a ton of milk.
Right.
Right? So because the economy for a dairy farm is so severe that even to waste just a couple of days with a baby male calf nursing on its mother is to put a farm in jeopardy of going out of business. So the tradition now, and this is 99.999% of all the dairy farms in the United States of America, kick this male calf off the farm within 2 days. Sometimes within even a day of birth. Mm-hmm. And those male calves are raised as veal calves in separate facilities. They're often raised in circumstances that are not pleasant, and it's most of the reason that veal has been such a terrible association. It also, by the way, does not produce delicious veal. So we had a choice, and instead, because we didn't want to go down that path, we decided to raise these male calves on their mothers, free choice milk, and also on pasture, and they spend their lives as cows are supposed to spend their life. Now, we didn't just do this because we are kind-hearted owners, and I'm a chef who believes in doing the right thing. We realized that we wanted to do it because we wanted to serve veal at the restaurant and create an economy for the farmer. Our farmer uses our land but is paid for everything that he grows and mm-hmm. everything he sells us. And so we realized that these veal calves can produce, if raised in the right way, can produce both delicious veal and an added economy to the farm. It got more complicated as we went along because we started to realize that these old breeds of cows don't eat all the grass on the perimeter of the fields. They're sort of picky. So we had to start bringing in goats. And goats eat bramble, and goats eat the grasses that the cows don't eat, and they push back the pasture, and they create more diversity for these cows to eat better grass, to produce better milk, and to produce better veal. So to get the milk that we wanted, we needed to both support the farm by buying veal, and then we needed to support the farm by buying goats. And I needed, as a chef, to figure out how to use the veal on the menu, and not just the veal loin, but the entire veal. And I needed to learn how to use the entire goat if I wanted to celebrate the cream. And that's really the story, if you can extrapolate that into, you know, kind of theory of a third plate. It's like we need to look at every region and in some ways every farm in that way.
Right. You know, you're talking about meat, but you talk in the book about so much to do with plants. And I think the awareness today of what the future of the planet's going to dictate is that we're not going to be eating a lot of meat at all, but we are going to be eating a lot of plants. Yeah. Tell me the background and how you do your dish, rotation risotto.
Yeah, rotation risotto was my interest in having flour for bread that came from a local farm. And I found a farmer who was growing incredible einkorn, a very old variety that we made a bread out of. And the Italians just loved this. And so I really started the book here. I went to the farm to find out the recipe. How do you grow this great wheat? What's it all about? And what I discovered standing in the middle of this gentleman's field, his name is Klaus Martens in upstate New York, is that I was surrounded by 2,200 or so acres of almost everything you can think of except for wheat. I was looking at buckwheat and barley and millet and flax, you know, leguminous crops, those crops that trap nitrogen from the air and give that great boost to the soil, mm-hmm. traditional cover crops that were planted in a very meticulous and timely fashion to create soil fertility for the wheat. And what I realized as a chef is I was the emperor with no clothes. I was here celebrating this one crop without looking at the whole farm. It's a little bit like looking at my veal calves and saying, I'm just going to take the veal chop. So I came back to the restaurant and worked on what I called a rotation risotto, which was a risotto of all these lowly grains, which, by the way, as you know, are stunningly delicious. I mean, that's what I should say about this rotation risotto, is not just to celebrate the great flavors of these lowly grains, but to also celebrate what this farmer Klaus doesn't really make money on, because there's no market for these grains. And so instead, they usually go into bag feed, and bag feed for a farmer is not something they can make money on. They're making money on the wheat, but what we need to do is support the whole farm.
Dan, fascinating point of view. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dan Barber is the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. You know what really does one's heart good? The fact that even after decades of eating their way through back roads and small towns, Jane and Michael Stern of RoadFood.com are still finding mom and pop places that are thriving, in spite of the chains. Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys. So what's the latest?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. So we're going to share a Road Food Stern secret with you. If you really want to find great fried chicken, go to a gas station. Because in Virginia, particularly...
Charlottesville, to be specific.
Yes. The Shell station, the Exxon Mobil, the Preston Avenue Shell, these are where the great fried chicken is to be found.
And what's great about these places is that from the outside, they look exactly like a boring humdrum chain gas station.
Because they are.
Because in fact, they are. You walk inside and nothing disabuses you of that thought, except for the aroma in the air. I mean, you look inside and there's beef jerky and
right.
Slim Jims and 100 kinds of beer and stuff. But off to one corner of these places is a little place where somebody is using, you know, good peanut oil, fresh peanut oil to make absolutely delicious fried chicken. And I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, in many of these places, there's actually no place to sit down and eat. It's all takeout. But it is such good fried chicken, it's well worth it.
Is it a case where you follow your nose to find which gas station it's going to be?
Well, your nose might smell gas and oil since it is a gas station.
Yeah, true.
It's word of mouth, really. I mean, that's the way I think it gets communicated among the fried chicken aficionados of Charlottesville is that, you know, you just kind of know it. I mean, from the outside, there's really no way to know. And some of these places have some pretty good side dishes, too, you know, like good Southern-style vegetables like collard greens and macaroni and cheese and stuff like that. But it's the chicken that stars, and each one is very different and really more delicious than you could ever expect in a gas station.
And this is nothing new. In 1869, yeah, a little history here, a newsman, George W. Bagley, called Gordonsville, Virginia, the chicken center of the universe. So the history of great fried chicken, delivering chicken to trains with Civil War soldiers
them.
Yeah. So transit and fried chicken in this part of the world is a marriage made in heaven.
Okay, now you have to name names.
Okay.
Okay.
The Brownsville Shell Station in the little town of Crozet, which is just outside of Charlottesville, has one single table indoors if you want to dine in there. It's a little two-top. And it's opposite the beer cooler, which has like 800 kinds of beer.
Near the fried pork rinds.
Near the fried pork rinds and beef jerky sticks. But you get your fried chicken and either eat it there or, as many people do, take it out to their truck or car. And this chicken is great because it's weird because it's not, it doesn't ooze juice when you bite. You know how most good fried chicken, you bite into it and juices are running down your chin?
Right.
This does not ooze rivers of juice. It's really luscious, but somehow all of that juiciness is held within the meat itself. So, you know, you crack through the crust of the chicken and bite into this meat that is like more tender than any chicken I've ever had. And this includes the white meat as well. I mean, the dark meat is ridiculous. All right, let's name a couple of other ones. The Chicken Coop, which is an Exxon Mobil station just south of Charlottesville.
Lovingston.
In the town of Lovingston, where a full three-piece chicken dinner with slaw roll and fried potato wedges costs you all of $5.59. The chicken there, it's like, it's got a really interesting crust on it. I don't know how they do this, but it's multifaceted. It's sort of like a million different facets on it. It's like a jewel. It's almost like Rococo chicken, if there could be such a thing. And, you know, you bite into it. And what's interesting is that it's very subtly flavored. At first you think, oh, this is good fried chicken. But it's one of those things you have a second bite and a third, and it gets better and better. And you realize it's way more complex than your tongue first told you that it is.
And, of course, when you ask the cook, what do you put in it to make it so multi-layered? You get a blank stare. Nobody's going to give out their secrets here.
The only answer we got when we asked these cooks, you know, what makes it so good is clean oil. They all said that.
Yeah, that's got to be key. So is there a third one?
Yes. The third one would be the Preston Avenue Shell, which is right in town in Charlottesville. And what's great about this place is not only is the fried chicken incredibly succulent, they also have really good side dishes like stewed apples dusted with cinnamon that are really good, and great collard greens, just like soft and kind of clumpy, laced with lots of slivers of pork.
And I do have to say the all-time great condiment, something called chicken butter, which is like chicken fat. It's obviously chicken juice and butter, and you pour it over the skin of the fried chicken. I mean, it has to be one of the greatest inventions ever.
A.K.A. schmaltz.
Schmaltz, right.
That sounds fabulous. Oh,
Okay. I've had my fried chicken fix. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the newly updated Road Food. Now, check out their finds at splendidtable.org. And just in case you want to take on a fried chicken recipe of your own, take a look at Hard Fried Chicken from the book Fried and True. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a woman working her way through Puerto Rico's joy of cooking, Cocina Criolla. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. Thanks to the film Julie and Julia, we all know the story of somebody cooking their way through Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Well, what that book is for French cooking, Cocina Criolla, is for Puerto Rican. Von Diaz is a journalist and multimedia producer working on issues of immigration, women, and food for the New School's journalism project. It's called Feet in Two Worlds. She's decided to cook her way through that Puerto Rican classic with her mother and grandmother at her side. Our correspondent, Melissa Clark, met up with Von in New York City.
Hey, Von. So nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So how did this Cocina Criolla project start?
So it started a couple years ago when I ended up with my grandmother's 1964 copy of the book. And so Cocina Criolla is described often as the joy of cooking of Puerto Rico. It's a book that lives on every Puerto Rican's cookshelf. I mean, I haven't gone to every Puerto Rican's cookshelf, but, you know, everyone I know has it. And I started looking through the book and seeing her handwriting and looking at the pages that she dog-eared, and it really spoke to me, and it really reminded me of these incredible summers and holidays that I spent with her on the island. So the project really started as this kind of sentimental homage to my grandmother, who I call Tata, who was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And she was an incredible cook. I mean, she was everyone's favorite cook. And she can't cook anymore. So in a lot of ways, it just started as me paying tribute to her and also exploring those recipes. But as soon as I dove into the actual recipes and started making things like beef tongue and, you know, whole turkeys swaddled in lard cloth, it then became a project that was so much about culture and identity and understanding the history of an island's cuisine that's fiercely underexplored.
Now, you're Puerto Rican by heritage. Did you grow up there?
I was born in Puerto Rico, but my family moved to Atlanta when I was about 5.
When you were growing up, other than being in Puerto Rico, did you run across other Puerto Ricans in your life, or did you feel isolated?
I felt incredibly isolated from Puerto Rican culture. I felt Puerto Rican. I felt connected to the island. But I grew up in the South eating grits and bacon. I'm a terrible salsa dancer. I am way more likely to listen to hip hop than I am to Latino music. And in school, I mean, I can remember one, maybe two Puerto Ricans the entire time I was in public school, except for, you know, sort of our family friends. And then in college, there was one Puerto Rican who I became really good friends with. But yeah, no, I mean, at the time, I mean, there wasn't a Puerto Rican community in Atlanta.
So, Von, your mom also got involved in the project. How did the whole three-generation thing happen?
When we moved to Atlanta, my mom made Puerto Rican food, but she's a really, I would describe her as a health nut. I mean, she eats mostly salads. She doesn't like pork. She doesn't like beef. She eats mostly vegetarian food. And so when she would make Puerto Rican food for me, it was very light. And I think that in a lot of ways, she stopped making Puerto Rican food because she couldn't figure out how to lighten it up. And so we ended up eating a lot of, I don't know, American food, baked chicken with vegetables and salads. And so then when it came to my hands, I feel like I'm merging the two people. I really want to stick to these traditional techniques and recipes and ingredients, but try to make them more palatable, try to make them lighter and fresher, because I also like to eat lighter food.
So it's a way of bridging your mom and your grandmother. You're kind of in the middle there.
Yeah, I'm definitely bridging their two ways of eating, their two ways of cooking.
So what are some of the dishes that your grandmother used to cook that you've been cooking when you've been going through the cookbook?
One of the dishes that I make really often is picadillo. It's ground meat that's seasoned with sofrito, and often olives and raisins are added. And definitely a bridge that's there is my grandmother used to make it with beef. My mother made it with ground turkey. I make it with pork and beef. And it's typically used as a filling. So most people have had empanadas or other deep fried fritters that are filled with beef. And so it's usually used as a filling, but my grandmother used to keep it on hand like other people keep lunch meat. You know, it was always in the fridge in a little container, and sometimes I would just scoop it out and eat it or like heat some up on a plate. And so I make that pretty often, and I find that I often have containers of it in my own freezer that I'll just pull out, you know, when I'm looking for something to eat.
So, Vaughn, what's it like cooking with your grandmother now?
Cooking with Tata is so different now than it was when I was 10 years old in Puerto Rico, which is when she really started to teach me some things that I still use now. She doesn't remember recipes, even the most basic thing. For example, you know, most dishes will have an adobo, which is just the most basic seasoning, garlic, olive oil. And when we cooked chicharrón de pollo together, she thought that it had recao in it, which is culantro, or a particular kind of herb that never, ever, ever goes in a sofrito. And she was really insistent that it should be in there. And so I had to sort of coax her out of believing this memory that wasn't there. So it's complicated because she really loves to cook. And for whatever reason, she loves my food and she loves anything that I cook for her. And so on the one hand, it's really fun because I see her sort of reactivated into this space that she lived in for so long. But I also see her get really confused and I have to help her just feel okay with the fact that we're doing something different and we're doing something new and it's going to taste really good at the end. And then we all sit down together and we eat it and she loves to eat.
Vaughn, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Take a look at Vaughn Diaz's videos and get a copy of the recipe they cooked together, Chicharrones de Pollo, at splendidtable.org. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table Refrigerator game. You send us five ingredients that you actually have in your fridge. I have to come up with a dish that you would actually make. You're the judge. Now, this is how the game works. Five ingredients you really have in your fridge. I get water, salt, pepper, and some kind of fat. And then three ingredients you actually have in your house. And every month, USA Weekend is going to publish the recipe with a photo, and you can find it on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. Who is today's contestant? We have Tricia calling from Dickinson, North Dakota. Tricia, welcome.
Hi there. How are you today?
I am very good. And I just want to make clear, I have not offered you any sort of, shall we say, financial remuneration?
No, ma'am.
Okay. All right. What are your five ingredients?
They are boneless chicken breast, fresh asparagus, fresh carrots.
Carrots, right.
Lemons.
Okay, that's number four.
And raspberry preserves.
Yeah. I knew there had to be a ringer because so far life was, you know, we were bouncing along here having a lovely time. Raspberry, no, but you know what? Really, raspberry preserves, we can deal with raspberry preserves.
Okay.
I'm going to use... you know, I always use olive oil, but I think it'd be fun to use butter. Have you got butter?
I have butter.
Good. Okay. That's my free fat. And then I get, you know, the water and the salt and pepper if I need it. And then let me think for a minute here. We want to have some fun with this. All right. This is what we're going to do. We're going to brine your chicken breasts. So they'll be plump and juicy and utterly succulent. So what you're going to do is use about 3 tablespoons of any kind of coarse salt. Could be sea salt, could be kosher salt. 3 tablespoons of that and 3 tablespoons of any kind of sugar, but ideally something brown.
Okay.
And then you're going to add cold water, very cold water, to cover it. And you're going to mix that around and then put that in the refrigerator for no more than about an hour and a half. Pull them out of the brine, rinse them and pat them dry.
Now what we're going to do, take those carrots, open up the chicken breast. So each chicken breast you're going to cut parallel to the counter, not all the way through. So you open it up like a book.
Okay.
Like a pocket. Right. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And you're going to take the carrots, shred them up, all right, and toss them in butter. And do you have fresh ginger?
I have not fresh. I have powdered.
All right. How about, let me think what else we can, oh, do you like chili?
I have fresh rosemary. I love chili.
Oh, you love chili?
Yes.
Oh, well, but you know what? Fresh rosemary would be delicious here, too.
I have that in the freezer.
You have that in the freezer. Okay, let's do this. Mm-hmm. You're going to toss that carrot. Now, do you actually have fresh chilies, you know, the pepper?
No, it's powder. That is powder.
Okay, all right. You're going to take a bit of chili powder. You're going to stir it into the carrots to taste, with salt and black pepper. Okay? And then toward the end of their cooking, you want them to be a little crunchy, but you've done shreds. So, you know, you're in pretty good shape here. You want to then add enough rosemary to give them a very subtle flavor. And you're going to also use some of the grated rind from a lemon. Because rosemary, lemon, and chili, believe it or not, is not a bad combination. And then you have the sweetness of the carrot. So set that aside and then let that cool down. You are going to take the asparagus, put some foil on a large shallow pan, trim off the tough ends, roll them with some olive oil and salt and pepper. That's it. Set them aside. Spread them on that pan.
Okay.
Put the carrots inside or on top of one half of your chicken breast. Put the other piece over the top.
Okay.
Do that with each one. Set them, you know, about 2 inches apart on a pan. And now what you're going to do is slow roast them about 300 degrees until they are tender and until they're about 160 when you tuck a thermometer, an instant reading thermometer, into the actual chicken, not the filling.
Okay.
When you pull them out, and you're going to pour a little white wine over them. So that's my second my third ingredient, because we have rosemary and we've got chili and now we've got white wine.
Okay.
So you'll start basting those about 5 minutes in. They're going to probably take about 20, 25 minutes. Take them out, but in that pan now, you're going to pour a little bit more white wine. And you're going to put it on two burners that you have on low, and you're going to bring the pan juices to a bubble. And you're going to swirl some butter into them, and you're going to add a little bit of that chili powder, and you are going to add some of that raspberry jam to taste. You want it to be sweet and savory at the same time. And if you put in a little extra rosemary, it would be fabulous. So you let that simmer. You keep swishing it around with a big, wide spatula. Put the asparagus under the broiler until they're, you know, getting blistery and they're tender. And all you have to do now is you make a bundle of asparagus on one side of each plate. You put the chicken breast to the other side. And you pour some of that sauce from the pan down the middle. And what you've got is this really interesting raspberry white wine juices from the chicken and the carrot sauce. It's really complex and it's really delicious. Hint of sweetness, but you could, and if you want it tarty, of course you add lemon.
Okay.
So that's it. Now, would you actually make this dish?
I think I would. I think it would be interesting and it sounds delicious. I didn't think you could put those five ingredients together and make them sound that good, but it sounds wonderful. My husband will love it.
When you tap dance often enough around it, you come up with something.
That's
Trish, thank you. I'm very proud of myself. I pulled it off. But thank you so much for playing Stump the Cook.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. You can find that recipe for spicy carrot bundles with raspberry white wine sauce that I came up with for Tricia in USA Weekend and at usaweekend.com and, of course, at splendidtable.org. Now, if you want to give me a challenge, head to the website, splendidtable.org.
You never call my name on the telephone. You never call my name on the telephone. I just see that call. try and call your phone, but you're never home.
We are talking to you this hour. Call us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Charity is on the line from Pittsburgh. Charity, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about Brie.
Brie, okay. All right.
Yeah, so I recently got married.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And for our appetizers, we set out a bunch of cheeses and spreads and olives and things. And we had ordered two big wheels of brie,
right.
Which we realized afterwards never got put out. So we came back from our honeymoon to about 15 pounds of brie in our fridge. Yeah, so my question is, if you have any favorite recipes or ideas to use up a sizable amount of brie?
Well, first of all, the purist will speak first, all right? Then the practical person will speak.
Okay.
Because if you've got a really good brie, all right, one that you just taste and you can taste sort of a mushroomy quality and it just fills your mouth and makes you feel good. That's my definition of a very good cheese.
Yeah.
You really kind of want to eat it straight. Because, I mean, the baking and the jam and all that on top of it always makes me cringe if it's a very good brie.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, I would say it's not going to last a long time. Is it running by any chance at this point?
No.
All right. Okay. It's still kind of firm?
Yeah.
All right. Great. And if it doesn't smell of ammonia, because if it smells of ammonia, it's over the hill. But let's say all things are good. This is a cheese to nibble on. At the end of a meal, the beginning, make a meal out of it. Maybe have a bit of fruit with it. But good bread and that brie, you're going to just love it. All that said, you're not going to eat, two people are not going to eat 15 pounds of brie. Freezing cheeses like brie is really, not a good idea. But if you are later going to take that cheese and puree it into a custard to make something like a quiche or crumble it over something you're going to bake, go ahead and freeze it. So take wedges of it. I would say, you know, the equivalent that you would end up with maybe a cup of cheese if you cut away the rind, which is probably a good idea to do anyway before you freeze it.
Okay.
All right. And freeze it in plastic bags, you know, date it and whatever. And then think about, you could do fondue with it, you know, like a dip with it. You could get yourself something like a pie crust, roll it out thin, put it on top of a pizza pan, and then slice pears or apples over that. Not a lot. You scatter them. Put some honey and black pepper on it and then dot it with the brie and bake it at about 400 degrees.
Sounds awesome.
It's absolutely awesome. And you could do variations on that forever. And the frozen brie, it'll do just fine. Now, obviously, there's wonderful things to be done by taking just some bowls that can go in the oven. Okay. Take the brie, puree it in the blender, cut it up, okay, with some heavy cream, some eggs. Look up a custard recipe, a baked custard recipe, all right? Puree some shallots in with it or some onion and some garlic. A little white wine, just a little, just for flavor. And then you pour that into these bowls. You take a large pan and you put the bowls in the pan. And you put that in the oven, and then you pour hot water all around those bowls halfway up, and you very gently shove it in the oven, and you bake it at 325 until that custard is set.
Uh-huh.
And then you can serve that cool in the bowl or, let it out of the bowl with a big green salad. And it's so elegant, and you can have it hanging around in the fridge for like 3 or 4 days. So it's the kind of thing where you do it way ahead and you invite friends over for it. We just threw this together. It's just a little... A little brie creme brulee.
Sounds great. I love custard, but I haven't made savory ones.
Well, the savory ones can...
I like that idea.
Use any recipe, but just eliminate the sugar.
Uh-huh.
And you're there. And the brie's going to make this a bit firmer. It's very forgiving. Just keep the heat low. Okay?
You're off and running. Okay, great. Thank you.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
You know, there's a great line about eternity is two people and a ham. And I'm wondering if half of eternity is, you know, perhaps a couple and... 15 pounds of brie. The brie is going to disappear quickly. We'll be back in a minute to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking with you this hour. Connect with us. You call 800-537-5252. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's see. Who's up next? Laura's on the line from Cleveland. Laura, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. So I have a little bit of a story for you.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
I love stories.
All right. Okay, so here's my story. Now, I've always loved to bake ever since I was a kid, but I've never really had any interest in learning how to cook until recently. So about 6 weeks ago, I started listening to the Splendid Table, looking for tips and tricks and ideas, and I was hooked pretty fast. So I've been going through all the podcasts I can get my hands on. So around the same time, maybe even later that week that I discovered the show, I noticed that I have a fig tree in my backyard with what looked like maybe ripe fruit. Now, so I've actually known that this fig tree has been here for years. I've lived in this apartment for 4 years, and I've always known the fig tree was there, but I never really paid any attention to it. But the day that I thought that I saw ripe fruit on it, I went up to it, picked one, pulled it open with my fingers, sniffed it, and decided it smelled safe, and took a bite. So, of course, it was delicious. And then I started digging, trying to figure out, you know, what kind of fig tree it is, what the fruit should look like when it's ripe, how to store them once I pick them, and then most importantly, of course, what new wonderful things I could try to cook that would include figs. And I have to admit that I was largely unimpressed by most of the recipes that I came across, so I never did try any of them. I mostly ended up just picking them, eating them fresh, or mixing them in with my yogurt for breakfast, which I think is something I had somewhere once in South or Central America, maybe Guatemala or something like
that.
But then it finally dawned on me that I should call you and ask for your advice.
Well, first of all, thanks for listening to the show.
Absolutely.
Great compliment. But I think one of the things, I'm just thinking about what you did with the yogurt, and one of the things that occurs to me, and it's very much a Middle Eastern inspired idea, is have you ever drained yogurt in a sieve, you know, just lined a sieve with a thin cloth or a clean towel and thrown the yogurt in there and let it drain so that you end up making a thick, thick, spreadable or spoonable what is called, it's called yogurt cheese or labneh. And it is something, it, you know, and you, the longer you drain it, you just drain it overnight in the fridge, and the longer you drain it, the thicker it gets. And of course, the liquid you can use however you wish. It's very healthy. Some people put it in baking. You know, if you're anything that calls for buttermilk, this is the kind of thing you could use instead of it. But that thickened yogurt, sweetened to taste with a bit of honey, and you crush salted pistachio nuts.
Okay.
Just lightly crush them, and you stir those in. And if you want to add some grated orange peel, it would be incredible, just a bit. And you sweeten that all to taste, and that's what you put on top of those figs.
Oh, that sounds great.
And that could be a dessert in a hot minute. That could be a breakfast. It could be a snack, and then you can take it in the opposite direction. You can make that yogurt cheese mixture savory, still with the pistachios. But now what you're going to do is you're going to add minced onion that you've tossed with lemon juice and let sit for about 15 minutes, you know, so it gets rid of that fire. So you have the minced onion, you have the pistachio nuts. If you have a little bit of any kind of salami or cured meat that you could mince up, and you fold that in as well. So the idea is that you're taking this yogurt, which is quite dense and lush, you're giving it the salty yet rich flavor of the pistachios, and you're giving it the, you know, that exclamation point of the onion with the lemon, and if you want a tad of garlic, and then you're giving it that spicy meat, and you put that on the figs, and that goes out with drinks.
Now, what kind of yogurt would you start with? A plain Greek yogurt?
Well, you know what Greek yogurt really is? It's yogurt that's been drained like this, but briefly. That's all it is.
Okay.
If you want to go for broke, you want a whole milk yogurt. But if you're concerned about the fat content, not to worry. A low fat's going to work just as well. And, of course, it should be a plain yogurt.
Right.
So that's one way to go. Now, another fabulous thing to do with figs is to caramelize them. So you put some butter in the pan, and you put some brown sugar in that pan, and you split a vanilla bean, and you put that in the pan, and you melt that all down together, and then you take your halved or quartered figs, and you put them in that pan as that syrup is just bubbling, and you roll them around in it, and then what you do is you just put them on a plate. You can arrange them very elegantly with some of that syrup, and you serve them that way, or with a tad of cream or mascarpone. and they're incredible. Okay. It's a natural for dessert. It's just fabulous. And then, of course, there's fig tarts. And what I love to do is I take a sweet pastry crust, which you probably can do in your sleep. And what I do is I pre-bake it, and then I line it with the thinnest sheet that I've rolled out with powdered sugar of marzipan or almond paste on the bottom. And then you look up a recipe for frangipani. And frangipani is a mixture of ground almond, egg, and sugar. Okay? And it's delicious when it's baked. It's fabulous. There's usually a little almond extract. You put that in there, and then you cut the figs, and you put the figs face up in it. You put a little bit of honey or some sugar on them so they'll glaze, and you bake that off.
That sounds wonderful.
It is out of this. It is so delicious, I cannot tell you. And it's rich. You know, it's rich. There's no denying it. But it's something you serve, you know, after a light meal.
I want to go home and try this right now. I just got a brand new mixer.
Has anybody else in the apartment building caught on to what's out there?
Well, you know, there's actually only two of us living in the building. It's a first floor, second floor split. But I live in Little Italy, which is a tiny little suburb in Cleveland that I'm sure this plant came over originally from Italy.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too.
Oh, a fig tree in the backyard. That brings back memories. I think every uncle and aunt and any one of the old timers who, you know, came over from what was referred to as the old country, there was the fig tree. Maren is on the line from Berlin, Germany. Maren, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good. Are you visiting in Germany or are you living there?
No, I'm living there. I just moved here a couple months ago. My husband got a job here, so I relocated from Pittsburgh.
Ah, so are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I'm loving it. It's really great. I'm getting to learn a little bit at a time, the language, and it's a huge city, so there's a lot to do.
Yeah,
it's really great. So I've been trying to experiment with new foods. I love to cook, and in the markets, I've been noticing a lot of fruits and vegetables that I've never used or they haven't been available where I used to shop. So I have been interested in using currants, red currants, but I don't really know what to do with them.
Okay. You've tasted them, I gather.
Yeah. So they're really juicy and they're not very sweet. They're a little...
Right. They tend to be a bit on the tart side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that people do with them is they make jelly. And it's, for centuries. And then they might use the currants also, either the jelly or the currants. They'll saute them, the whole currants, into dishes of, how can I put this? You could do it with light things like fish or chicken, but pork, ham, game, you know, things that are robust because of the contrast with that tart, sweet fruit. Played against it.
What about vegetarian? I eat a lot of legumes and, you know, beans and sometimes tofu. Yeah, like that.
Well, you know what? This is one of the things you can do with the currants is that you can cook them lightly with a bit of vinegar, a bit of sugar, mm-hmm. and then if you want to, a tad of salt, and you can add garlic to them or savory herbs. And then what you could do is you could toss chunks of tofu in that, cold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, serve it cool. And if you put that on, I'm just trying to think of something that would work with the tofu and on stir-fried greens. Just pile that on on tart greens. You know, like a broccoli rabe or something like chicory or even dandelion. It could be really, really delicious.
That sounds good.
And, of course, people love to bake and cook with currants. So you can puree. I like, because they do have seeds, as I recall. It's been a long time since I've run into a fresh currant.
Yeah, I think they're really tiny, and they don't add too much to the texture of it.
No, and a lot of people just say the devil with it, and, you know, it's like eating blackberries or raspberries. Mm-hmm. You just go for it. But if you want to, you can put them through a food mill. You know, just puree them through a food mill. And then what you can do is toss that pulp with... basic salad dressing that you like. And then that becomes something that you can spoon over almost anything. And if you think about something like fresh green beans tossed with the fresh currants that you've crushed and you've mixed with just the smallest amount of sugar, It would be delicious. And again, cold would be wonderful. So
yeah.
You see where I'm going? You can do a savory version by treating it as though you're making a relish, you know, and then you can do it as a sweet and add sugar. You can add vanilla. Vanilla is wonderful with currants. A little grated lemon zest. Yes. And the other thing people do is they mix the currants, they crush them. And then they put them into a bottle of vodka or gin or local, any kind of local spirit, and let them sit for a couple of weeks and then strain them. And it turns the clear spirit into something very beautiful to look at, and you get that fresh currant taste. And you put that over ice with spritzy water.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, so you better buy up those currants.
Okay.
Enjoy it. It's an adventure.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Talking.
Oh, thank you. Take care, Bart. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Currants come a couple of ways. They're red, black, and white, and they're very tiny. They look like miniature grapes. And if you run across them, sneak a taste before you buy them, because they can sometimes be so sour they're a waste. But fool around with them, because they really can be delicious. And of course, red currant or currant jelly is sort of this great classic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And you can call us, 800-537-5252. You know that summer's going south when the slow cooker shows up on your countertop. But right now, we're not into pot roasts or beef chili. We want vegetables in that magical pot. Vegetable combos for supper that we don't need to hover over. Well, for new takes, our producer Sally Swift tracked down Faith Durand of The Kitchen, and co-author of The Kitchen Cookbook.
Faith, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is your take on the slow cooker, previously known as the crock pot?
I think it's like your sous chef or your prep cook.
Huh, I hadn't thought about it that way.
It does the hard work while you're busy doing other more glamorous and exciting things in the kitchen. It's the little tool that just keeps on going in the background.
I think traditionally people think about chili con carne and stewed meats. What about vegetables? Do you have a take on using it for vegetarians and
there
vegans?
There are a lot of vegetarian recipes you can do in the slow cooker. Of course, vegetarian chilies, vegetarian soups, all of those sorts of things. But I think when I think about vegetarian meals, I think more in terms of components. So the slow cooker is a wonderful tool for making a big pot of beans, for instance, or making a pot of vegetable stock overnight, or even doing a batch of baked potatoes.
What? How would you do baked potatoes?
You wrap them up, you put them in the slow cooker, and let them go.
Wow, so you're just essentially using it like an oven.
Exactly.
I noticed that you talk about doing oatmeal, which I never would have thought
of.
Yes. So talk me through that.
I like to do steel-cut oats, first of all. I love steel-cut oats. They're firmer. They get a little creamy in the slow cooker. And you simply put them in overnight with milk or water. You can add spices. You could add dried fruit. And you just set it on low, let it cook overnight. And in the morning, you wake up to a hot bowl of oatmeal.
So no pre-soaking with that?
Nope. Nope.
It takes the whole thing. And what about, tell me how you would do a vegetable stock? Because that seems like a long time to be... Vegetable stocks tend to be quicker for the most part.
Sure. I think that you can do, first of all, you could do a quicker vegetable stock. Let's say you want one for dinner in the evening. You start it at 10 in the morning, go away, it cooks for 6 hours. It'll be great. But sometimes I like to do a deeper, richer vegetable stock with roasted vegetables, maybe tougher, harder vegetables. And you can let that go overnight, 8 hours, 10 hours on low, of course.
You know, it's interesting because I don't think that we necessarily embrace really slow-cooked vegetables. I think we're still very much oriented toward liking our vegetables crisper than softer.
Yes.
Which, what's your take on that?
I think that there are a lot of vegetables that benefit from long, slow cooking. And personally, I tend to gravitate towards those. For instance, I love green beans when they've really cooked for a long time in that Greek-style way with some spice and some tomatoes. They get silky and supple and in that kind of long, slow cooking. And the slow cooker can help you do that.
And what about cooking greens? Have you ever done any greens in a slow cooker?
I don't do a lot of greens in the slow cooker, although I have been meaning to work with collard greens because collard greens, they need that long,
I know,
slow
that seems
simmer.
Perfect to me.
And they just make such a wonderful sauce that I think a long overnight cook in the slow cooker, especially with a lot of aromatics and a lot of garlic, would be absolutely delicious. Mm-hmm.
Just like those Southern mothers used to do.
That's right.
And have you taken on fruit with the slow cooker?
Absolutely. You can use the slow cooker to do the long, slow, steamy work of cooking down fruit into apple butter or pear butter. It's kind of a fall chore, but it's a wonderful treat to have around. You just throw a batch of applesauce or apple puree into the slow cooker and let it cook for a long time, and you're left with, you know, that sweet, spreadable, creamy fruit butter.
Okay, and what do you, if people are going to go out and buy a slow cooker, what do they need to think about?
There's not a lot of, you know, I think there are a lot of brands that are great. The things that I would look for personally, besides the basics, every slow cooker should have a low and a high setting, which are fairly standard temperatures. But the other thing that I look for is I like my slow cooker to have a warm setting as well, which most have. And then also a timer. So you can set it to cook for a certain number of hours and then automatically switch to warm when it's done cooking. That's really what gives you the convenience factor. You can walk away and it'll turn itself off and turn itself on.
Is bigger better with slow cookers, or what size?
Not necessarily. I know some people who have a lot of different sizes. I think I use a 6-quart slow cooker, which is good for a lot of things. But if it's just a household of one or two people, and you know that you're not going to eat 6 quarts of whatever you're going to cook at any one time, you can get smaller ones. And I think that's often very useful. However, the slow cooker is great to cook things for freezing, so keep that in mind as well. Mm-hmm. Don't just make one batch of beans. Make a lot of beans and freeze them for later.
These are all great ideas. Faith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Faith Durand is the executive editor of The Kitchen and co-author of The Kitchen Cookbook. Now head to splendidtable.org for their recipes for curried vegetable and chickpea stew and slow cooker enchiladas. Well, that's our show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this from Doug Larson, who said, "Life expectancy would grow by leaps and bounds if green vegetables smelled as good as bacon." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now head to splendidtable.org to find all sorts of good things. Past interviews, recipes for any occasion, our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. Everything is there. splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with production assistance from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our theme music is composed by Sam Keenan. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.